live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
All right, starting with some NBA today. At exactly 2:16 p.m. yesterday, a Woj bomb dropped. Carmelo Anthony was traded. Yes, I said it. And the reason I said it is because pretty much nobody else is talking about this. I mean, there was a time when Carmelo Anthony, Hall of Fame lock, being traded was not just breaking news. I mean, that was like shattering news. It was the kind of story that would dominate an entire show. And not just because it was the trade of a perennial all-star, but because it was the trade of one of the most polarizing guys in the league. And then the argument would rage, right? Would he make his new team better? Will he bog the offense down? Did the old team give up on him too quickly? Did they get enough in return? Except right now, exactly nobody is asking any of those questions. The Rockets traded Melo to the Bulls along with cash so they could sign Kenneth Faried. And that's the thing about the Rockets. They weren't even angry. They weren't angry. It wasn't about the fact that they had to part with a 10-time All-Star. It was the fact that the league office was closed yesterday, which meant that Houston wing James Nunnally had to lose his 10-day contract in order to complete that transaction. Now, I know that's a little bit complicated, so let me run that back one more time. The Rockets just traded Carmelo Anthony to sign Kenneth Faried, who was sitting on Brooklyn's bench. Pretty humiliating for Melo. But then to make matters even worse, they traded him with cash to Chicago. And not only that, but Houston was not pissed about having to trade Melo. They were pissed about having to lose a guy on a 10-day contract. Are you following this? Zoom in a little closer. Melo was traded with money in order to clear space for a Nets bench player, and the Rockets are pissed that they lost a 10-dayer because the league office was closed. They just paid to get rid of a 10-time All-Star, and they wanted to keep a 10-dayer. And I get it. It makes complete sense. But it only gets worse for Melo, because the full tweet from Woj was, and I quote, "The Houston Rockets have agreed to trade Carmelo Anthony and cash to the Chicago Bulls, league sources tell ESPN." So, Carmelo Anthony and cash going to Chicago, and no mention of who is going back to Houston. And the reason for that? It doesn't really matter. And there is another key word here. It's not Carmelo Anthony for cash. It is Carmelo Anthony and cash. One of the greatest to ever play the game is being shipped to an 11-36 Bulls team, and Chicago is being paid to take him. That's like one step removed from just throwing this guy up on Craigslist or leaving him out on the curb. Like, if you can haul him, you can have him. The Bulls snapped a 10-game losing streak yesterday. They look at Melo arriving, and they're like, "Nah, we're good. Nah, we're good." I mean, do you remember when the Bulls rolled out the red carpet to recruit Melo? That was only a few years back. That was not long ago. They were going to add Melo to Derrick Rose and Jimmy Butler, maybe add Paul Gasol, with Tom Thibodeau leading the way. They were going to try to take down LeBron. That was 2014. Jimmy Butler is on his second team since then. Derrick Rose is like on his 50th. And Tibbs was just fired. And now Melo is not only being traded, Melo is being traded with money. Damn, life comes at you fast. Life will catch up to you in a hurry, because that's where Melo is right now. Well, that, and technically being a Bull, even though he will never play for the Bulls. Quick, can you name the teams that Melo has been with since April? I mean, did you even remember that he played with the Thunder last season? Because it's kind of easy to forget. And then there was that short run with the Rockets. And now it's the Bulls, right? That's three teams since April. Wrong. Chicago is actually his fourth team since April. He was also dealt from OKC to Atlanta over the summer before he went to Houston. So, that's OKC to Atlanta to Houston to Chicago. That's not a career. That is a series of redirected flights. Yeah, and they all thought that I was number one on the downgrade list. My man has been redirected time and time again. This is what happens when you're trying to fly from OKC to Chicago, but weather reroutes you south. And that's since April. And that's for a Hall of Famer. And he's not done. Well, I mean, he is done. He's done, but he's not done moving. Because the Bulls are not going to keep him. They're going to waive him. And that means he will never play a game for them, which means that his Bulls jersey can go right alongside in the rafters alongside the Hawks jersey from back in July. In other words, Rasheed Wallace's Atlanta Hawks career cannot believe the run that Melo had in Atlanta and Chicago. Here's the thing. I'm not even bringing this up to clown Melo. Not at all. In fact, it's not to clown Melo. It's really easy to clown him these days. It's become so easy that it's actually worth remembering this guy is a 10-time All-Star. This guy's a 3-time Olympic gold medalist. He's a scoring champ. He's an NCAA champ. He's had the kind of career that you dream of. And having the end of nightmares, too. 4 teams in 9 months. Again, that's a Hall of Famer, not some ham and egger. That's a guy just trying to scratch and claw to make it in the league and stay in the league. A guy living on a series of 10-dayers, not a Hall of Famer. And most of all, it's further proof that almost no athlete gets to go out the way they want. Almost no athlete, even the very best athletes, get to go out on their own terms, especially Melo. And even worse, worst of all, it does not appear to be even the end. Because he didn't hang it up after that disaster in OKC, and he didn't hang it up when it was even worse in Houston. And you know how badly he wants to come here to LA and be a Laker. Never mind that the Lakers do not need this guy at all. Contrary to what LeBron and Melo think, the Lakers do not need him at all. Which means there could be more jerseys and more trades and more salary dumps and more bench guys being chosen over Melo. I don't doubt that Melo can still score in the right situation. I just don't know that there is a right situation. Hey, listen, his legacy, he can do whatever the hell he wants with it. But usually the guy is the last one to know. Bro, lights are being flashed in the bar. It is last call, Melo. To quote the legendary Dirk Nowitzki, shut it down. Let's go home. Sometimes the last guy to know is the guy who should know. And in this case, it is Melo. The signs are all there. 4 teams in 9 months. Never playing for 2 of them. And now being shipped to one of the worst teams in basketball. They're being paid to take you and they don't want you. Your legacy, my man, but you are jacking it up. Man, you can't spend what you made. Why not shut it down right now? My man must really, really love basketball. Ian O'Connor is my guest. Ian, great to have you back on. How are you?
Hey, Jim, how's it going?
Good, good. Good to talk to you, Ian.
You too.
Now, you literally wrote the book on Bill Belichick, and you and I spoke earlier this season about that book and about him. But take me back to Sunday night. After that game, what did you see when you saw Bill Belichick? I mean, after they won, did that look like the Belichick that most people are accustomed to seeing?
No, and he doesn't, as you know, Jim, in the workplace 24/7, he's going to be that one-dimensional character that he created long ago. And that is that robotic tone, those flat-line responses at press conferences where he says as little as possible. And it's by design. He just doesn't want to ever give away any information or any thoughtful response generally to questions, even in moments of great glory and triumph like Sunday night. But afterward, I just followed him around a bit and, you know, human interactions with people, conversations that flow easily, hugs, posing for pictures. He didn't do a lot of that, but more than people would imagine, I guess, just based on his public persona. I think there are just a lot of people around the country, and I wanted to get this across in my book, that have no idea that there is a little bit of a Jekyll and Hyde thing going on with Belichick, and that human side of him, really, he only shows to that inner circle of friends and associates he has away from the facility.
Tuesday's Daily Jungle is brought to you by my crew at Capterra. Hey, now it's 2019. Are you still doing things the old way at work? New year, new you, right? So start the year off right by replacing that software that causes you angst and agony every single day. You know what I'm talking about. You know the one. You can find software you love that fits your business needs using Capterra.com. Capterra is the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. So join the millions of people who use Capterra each month to find the right tools for their business. Even I had to come to grips. This is not 1999. It's 2019. I've got a couple of hundred affiliates. That base is growing. I have to stay buttoned up and in contact with them, and Capterra helps me do that. You should do the same. Go to Capterra.com/Rome for free today. Find the right tools to make 2019 the year for your business. Again, Capterra.com/Rome. Capterra, Capterra.com/Rome. Capterra.com/Rome. Yeah, I was going to say, Ian O'Connor, my guest, I was going to say, Ian, that in your piece, you described that as, quote, human Bill. So if you had to guess, how often does human Bill show up during an NFL season, and why doesn't he let more people see human Bill?
Well, I think he shows up in his office, behind locker room walls and doors at that facility at Gillette, where he's a lot better one-on-one with players than anyone would really suspect who doesn't know him. And he was not that way, Jim, in Cleveland when he had the 4 losing seasons out of 5. I talked to many former Browns players for my book, and they basically said to a man that we never thought he cared about us as people, that he didn't care about our families. He only cared about us and what we could do for him on Sundays. He changed in New England. It was pretty clear early on that he realized that was a mistake in his approach, and he did try to reach out at least away from the public arena, that behind closed doors, he would try to reach out and connect with his players as human beings. So he doesn't show it really ever for the cameras, but in private, he's pretty good. Listen, there's no way he could be the way he is for the cameras in his news conferences all the time, or he'd never be able to inspire these ever-changing circle of players to perform at the highest level for basically 18 years. So I think he's underrated in that aspect of his coaching.
I think that's critical. That's a key point, which I'll get to in a minute. Ian O'Connor joins us. His most recent book is called Belichick. It is out right now. Now, Ian, in a moment that's now carved into the hearts of Chiefs fans, Kansas City had that game won with that interception, only to have it called back because Dee Ford had lined up in the neutral zone. During this run, the Pats have had numerous moments like that, though. The tuck rule, Russell Wilson on the goal line, moments that seem like they're lucky. But are they? Is it luck, or is it something else?
They weren't lucky in Super Bowl 42, where it seemed like if only one of 17 things had gone their way against the Giants, they finished as the greatest team ever at 19-0. I think there are moments, if Welker holds on to the ball in the second Super Bowl against the Giants, they win that one too. So they've had some bad breaks as well. They got a great break against Seattle when Wilson threw the ball, but I don't think they're lucky, and of course, as Branch Rickey once said, luck is the residue of design, right? I think the Patriots are about design, not luck, and just execution and precision, and they treat every day in the offseason and preseason as Game 7 of the World Series, and I just don't think any other franchise does it to that extent, and that's what I think separates Belichick and the Patriots from everyone else in the NFL.
All right, so it's the 9th Super Bowl trip for Belichick and Brady. We're so used to it by now, we're almost numb to the whole thing. You have been around sports a long, long time. You've seen everything there is to see. Have you ever seen a more impressive run than this from a head coach?
Jim, I think it's the greatest dynasty in American sports in my lifetime, college or pro. You might say, well, what about Gino Auriemma with the UConn women, John Wooden at UCLA, and even Nick Saban at Alabama? I think in the college game, when you can recruit the best players in America every year, it's a little different. In the pros, of course, you're punished for being good. You pick at the bottom of the barrel in the college draft, and Bill's doing that every year. So for him to have won 5 championships, to be going to his 9th Super Bowl as a head coach, really 12 overall as an assistant as well, I think it's so much harder to do it today in pro sports, particularly in the NFL, where the whole system is designed to prevent you from having a dynasty. I've never seen anything more impressive than what the Patriots have done since 2001.
Ian O'Connor is the senior writer for ESPN. His most recent book is called Belichick, and you can get it right now. Now, Ian, if you reach a single Super Bowl, that's a remarkable accomplishment. It means you did a hell of a job that year. He's done it so many times that it should be hard to pick his best coaching job, but might this be it? Is it the best coaching job that he's ever done? And if so, what do you think sets it apart?
I think it's in the top three, Jim. I still think 2001 stands alone because he could have gone back to Bledsoe in that first championship season. Obviously, Bledsoe gets hurt against the Jets in that first Sunday after 9/11 that they played football. Brady takes over. You know, Brady's numbers weren't that great. By the time Bledsoe got healthy again in November, a lot of coaches would have gone back to him. And Bill decided to stay with Brady, and it's the best choice he ever made. So to upset the Rams in that Super Bowl, the Tuck Rule game, yeah, they got a little bit lucky on that one, certainly. But Vinatieri had to make the greatest kick in NFL history to win that game against Oakland. I still think that job is number one. But this one this year, when you look at how thin and relatively weak that roster was this year, you can blame Belichick, the GM, I guess, for that. But Belichick, the coach, I watched this team a lot this year because my book was out for obvious reasons. I never thought that they were good enough, really, to get to this point. But they're playing now at such a higher level than they did for most of the season, despite the dearth of playmakers. They're healthier now than they've been all year, and they're really confident. So I do think they'll beat the Rams in this Super Bowl and get number six.
Ian O'Connor is my guest. All right, then. You know, if we go back into slightly less than 12 months ago, Belichick, of course, had benched Malcolm Butler in the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. The Patriots lose that game, and it seemed like things were about to fall apart. I mean, there were reports of issues between Brady and Belichick, about Gronk being unhappy. The list goes on. How were they able to get everything back together again and to peak at the right time?
Well, it started with Brady coming back because, and listen, there were other reports before my book came out by some great reporters about the friction in that relationship. I added a couple of details and maybe a money quote, but Brady was seriously thinking as late March about walking away because he really had had enough with Belichick's unforgiving, unrelenting style of coaching for 18 years, and the Butler benching maybe was sort of a bit of a final straw. And so and I think that's the reason he didn't go to OTAs. He's the only starting quarterback who didn't. That's a very un-Brady-like thing to do, and I believe he sent a clear message to Belichick about how he felt. But once it got back to football, once their relationship and partnership overcame or survived that moment in time, it worked again. They have the most successful transactional partnership in the history of maybe American team sports, and it works. There doesn't need to be love and affection. So I think once it got back to football and they overcame that tumultuous moment, they were fine. And here they are again, ready to, again, I think they'll win number six. If not this year, at some point they'll get there. And so I'm not surprised that it's happened the way it has.
We're talking to Ian O'Connor for a few more moments. Again, his most recent book is Belichick, and it's out right now. So, Ian, if they win number six right now, then the run of Super Bowl victories started with a win over the Rams, and if they beat them again, could you see any combination of Bill Belichick, Tom Brady, and or Gronk retiring? And would it feel like a poetic end for Belichick and Brady in particular?
Well, I could see certainly Gronk retiring, although he's had a bit of a resurgence of late. Most of the season, he's looked physically beaten to hell. So I could see that happening. I think both Belichick and Brady will be back for number seven, even if they win. I think Brady, after sort of inspiring the organization to trade his much younger successor in Garoppolo, that and talking about playing until at least age 45 to quit at age 41 would feel, to me, unlikely that he would do that. And so I think he's going to be back, win or lose. And I would say the same for Belichick, who to me is a young 66. He loves doing what he does. And I think he's got another 4, 5, 6 years in him in this league.
All right, so in terms of the matchup itself, we know about Belichick, the thing that he likes to do, he wants to take away your biggest strength. Of course, the Rams have so many different offensive weapons. How do you think that he'll approach the Rams' offense?
That's a very good question. And before the Chiefs game, I thought he would really focus on Tyreek Hill because of what Hill did to him during the regular season with the 3 touchdowns, 142 receiving yards. Before the last Super Bowl against the Rams 17 years ago, he told his friend Chris Berman, "Marshall Faulk will not beat us in this game." I don't know if he feels the same way about Gurley, but that might be a matchup that he really focuses on. And I don't know if he's going to treat him the same way he did Marshall Faulk, but I wouldn't be surprised.
And then finally, if you were going to give Sean McVay any advice on how to prepare for Belichick and Brady, what would you tell McVay?
Be yourself. Certainly he doesn't need my advice. He's been unbelievable early on in his coaching career, but just whatever you do in this game, just be who you are. Don't be intimidated by the specter of Belichick. A lot of coaches in the NFL are intimidated by him. Tom Coughlin is one who never was, which is why I think he won those two Super Bowls, because he worked with Belichick under Parcells with the Giants. Don't be intimidated and just be yourself.
Ian O'Connor is a senior writer for ESPN. He is the author of four books. Three of them are New York Times bestsellers, and the most recent is Belichick. And you can get that right now. It is out. Ian, great to get caught up.
I don't suspect this is going to go on for two more weeks,
but it's still going on. Here is that play one more time, this time with feeling.
Third down and 10. Breeze from the gun. Takes the snap. Goes to the near side. Hit early. Fair. Where's the flag?
You don't get one.
Early hit on Tommy Lee. Sean Payton is all the way down at the 10. Unbelievable no call.
Wow, not a flag to be found.
Unbelievable.
That's the second time. Can't challenge it.
Normally I'd call those guys out for being homers, but they were right. That call, that local call was justified. Where is the flag? How is there no flag? And seeing it and hearing it again 2 days later, it's still bad. In fact, it's actually worse right now than it was the first day and yesterday. I mean, it's that bad. So no wonder you have PFT pointing out that the league's rules do in fact allow the commissioner to take extraordinary measures. Quote, if any club action, non-participant interference, or calamity occurs in an NFL game which the commissioner deems so extraordinarily unfair or outside the accepted tactics encountered in professional football that such action has a major effect on the result of the game. End of quote. Now, allow me to read a little further. Quote, the commissioner's powers include, this section to include, the reversal of a game's result or the rescheduling of a game, either from the beginning or from the point at which the extraordinary act occurred. End quote. In other words, the commissioner could theoretically order both teams back onto the field in the Superdome and then restart that game from the moment where Nickell Robey-Coleman committed the PI that was not called. He literally could do that. He could order them. He's got the power. He has the authority vested within. He could order them back onto the field. The Saints know this, which is why Saints receiver Michael Thomas tweeted, quote, Rule 17, Section 2, Article 3 at NFL, with broken heart emoji and a Saints logo. And then he chased that with, hey, Roger, pick up the phone. Mike, I see you working. I respect it. But you better know that Raj is not going to pick up that phone. That's not happening. I mean, it would be awesome if he did. I'd be totally down for starting that game right back up again tomorrow night, but that's not happening. Even though he does have the power. He's got the power, but he will never use it for that. And yes, it was not just the NRC committed pass interference. And it wasn't called. It wasn't just that. He committed it, and he admitted it, and it wasn't called. So I'm not sure that that counts as a so-called calamity in the rule book, but it's as close as a miscall might come to being a calamity. And again, if it is a calamity, Roger can order them back on the field. So a day later, the Saints players are not feeling any better. Teron Armstead said, quote, I didn't know much about that rule, but I read it and it's in place. I mean, I think our case would be the case to make the rule come to life, end quote. Again, I agree. If you were ever going to use it for a situation, for something that happened on the field, anything short of somebody going fan man and flying onto the field mid-play, then that was the play and that was the game to do it. But it wasn't done because it's not going to get done. Armstead said the whole thing hurts. Quote, I'm trying to stop crying, for real, like a baby, just thinking about everything in totality, just being so close to actually going to the Super Bowl from somebody like me from a small town in Illinois. A small school, and I'm about to go to a Super Bowl. Man, that bleep is tough. It's like heartbreaking. We battled. We're all sore, hurting, and it was all for nothing. That bleep sucks. Most blatant call you'll ever see. It changes lives. We're not asking for a favor or anything. Just make the call. End quote. It's a powerful statement. I do not disagree with anything he just said there. they're not looking for a favor. They're only looking for the refs to do their job. And if your argument is that mistakes like that are part of the game, my response is they shouldn't be part of the game. Not blatant mistakes like that. The refs need to do better. So, the league is not going to restart that game. But the Washington Post did report that the league is going to look at making pass interference reviewable. Well, more specifically, such a rule change will be, quote, discussed at length along with additional fouls the coaches feel should be subject to review. So there you go, Saints fans. That's got to make you feel a hell of a lot better, right? Nothing like a detailed discussion sometime after the fact to make you feel like justice was served. Yeah, I mean, they're not going to replay it. They're not going to bring them both back. You're still not going to the Super Bowl, but there is going to be a detailed discussion. You got to feel good about that. Most Saints fans I know are going to watch the Super Bowl and say, yeah, we could be in that game. It should be us in that game, but at least the league is going to have a sit down and talk about what happened at some point. And you know what? That's even better than being in the Super Bowl. Worse yet, Saints fan, I think you know how this goes. I think you know how these conversations go. They'll talk about it for a while. Maybe it'll go on. It'll go one or two ways. They'll decide to table it for another time because this is not the first time that this has been raised. It's not the first time it's come up. It's not the first time they've thought about making PI reviewable. And there have been reasons that it was shot down in the past. Or what they'll do is they'll come up with some convoluted, watered down rule that will somehow make it even worse than it already is right now. Sincerely, the catch rule. I hate to say it, but when it comes to getting it right, I've got about as much confidence that the league will get it right in a conference room as I have that the refs got it right on the field that day, which is to say, none at all. If we do come out of this with a new review rule, that would be impressive. And if it's a new review rule that actually works, that's actually an improvement, that would be a miracle. But it's still not going to take away anything that happened on Sunday. It's not going to make Sean Payton feel better. It's not going to make the Saints players feel better. I know it's not going to make the Saints fans feel any better. And to quote Teron Armstead, that bleep is tough. That bleep sucks. Sean Livingston joins us yet again. Sean, it's so good to have you back. How are you, Sean?
Good, Jim. Thanks for having me on, always.
Always good to have you, Sean. Thank you. Listen, you guys are coming off a nice win over the Lakers last night. That was the team's eighth straight win. Also a game, Sean, where Klay Thompson goes off with 44 points, including 10 of 10 from beyond the arc to start the game. Look, I know you've seen him do a lot of crazy things over the years. What did you think as you were watching him last night?
It's a movie, Jim. I mean, when he gets hot like that, it really is like watching a movie, you know, like or a video game, right? I'm sure you see on social media, video game Clay is like, when he gets hot, you know, it just goes unconscious, and you know, and then when him and Steph are hot, it's just like, it's unbelievable to watch, you know, and even this is my fifth year with the team, and you know, those guys, it starts to become routine, you know, when they hit shots. But, man, when they get hot like that, you know, you just see Clay. He just goes he goes crazy.
Sean Livingston, my guest. All right, Sean, so what's more impressive to you, video game Clay going 10 of 10 to start that game or him going up for four dunks against Denver last week?
Man, I'm gonna go with video game Clay. I mean, I know he's a shooter, you know, so he might think it's easier. He's not really a high flyer. The four dunks are impressive, but you know, 10 threes in a row like that, that's pretty crazy.
Sean Livingston, my guest, to see him pull up from where he does and Steph both, it's just amazing. And then you mentioned Steph at the other end of the spectrum. Sean, he had that really strange sequence last night where he broke free and it looked like he was going in for a dunk and then wiped out, but then he got up and then he attempted a three and then it was an air ball. I mean, look, it's a hard game. It could happen to anybody, except I thought that it could happen to anybody except Steph. What did you think when you saw that sequence?
man, you know what? Honestly, first thing first, I was like, clear, like, man, don't get hurt.
Right.
You know, like, whatever you do, just don't get hurt. You know, like, I don't care if you win Shaqton of the Year, whatever the case may be. But we were laughing about how fast he got up. Like, the recovery was unbelievable. You know, like, to get up that fast and chase the ball down and then shoot a three. Like, usually those shots go in, you know, like, if a crazy sequence happens, and then he'll just shoot a shot from anywhere, and then it usually goes in. But that time, you know, the gods weren't on his side.
He did get up fast, too. Sean Livingston, my guest. Like, if you get up fast enough, maybe nobody will see that it actually happened. And if I knock down that three, then it really didn't happen. You know, it was interesting, too. Luke Walton was saying, and he's a former Warriors assistant, so he has pretty good insight. He said that he thinks that you guys are, quote, starting to find your stride, not just against us, but against the league. I mean, you're right in the middle of it, Sean. Does it feel that way to you? Does it feel like you guys are finding your stride right now?
I think so. I mean, you know, you look at Luke. He was with us for a couple of years, and he understands, you know, kind of our energy, our spirit, how we play. And just looking at us, I think past couple of weeks, really just finding our energy, our chemistry together. Obviously, guys are playing unbelievably well. Steph, Clay's been playing a lot better in January. And, you know, guys are stepping up their game. But I think as a team, you know, we're starting to find the right footing, and hopefully, you know, go into the break with, you know, a little momentum going into the break.
Golden State guard Sean Livingston joins us once again. You know, Sean, you mentioned energy and spirit. Something I saw you talk about earlier this season as one of the leaders in that locker room. I know that you look for those types of things. You like to watch your team and to see its body language and to see its spirit. How would you describe the body language and the energy and the spirit that the team's had throughout the season? Did it look right to you?
Throughout the season?
Yes.
I would say it's been up and down. It's been up and down. You know, it's a hard year. Yeah, just because of the fact of you look at what we've done the past 4 years, going playing from, you know, September, October, whatever it is, all the way until June. And then you tag on the expectations of winning. You know, obviously Kevin comes here and then it's automatically you guys championship or bust. So, you know, you throw the weight of the expectations, the media, everything off the court with what we've been doing on the court, and then it just gets harder and harder every time. I mean, that's why greatness, you know, and I'm not saying, you know, we're in that category yet, but at the same time, you know, it's like it's the hardest thing to do, you know, because it gets harder and harder every time. So looking at this year, you know, it's been an incredibly challenging year, but at the same time, I think, you know, we've handled the adversity really well, and I think we're starting to find our stride.
Well, Sean, maybe you can't say it, but I certainly can. I think that greatness is there, and it's been there for quite some time. And when you have that kind of greatness and you have that kind of success, it seems kind of natural that at some point complacency is going to set in. And how that manifests itself, whether the guys start to tune each other out or tune the coach out, you don't really see that. And I guess from the outside looking in, if it does happen, it doesn't happen for very long. How has the team been able to prevent that sort of complacency from setting in, despite all that success?
I think it's just awareness, you know, trying to have some awareness. You know, coach is great, Coach Kerr. You know, those guys are great in just trying to keep our perspective in order, right? Understand what we're doing for a living, understanding the type of opportunity that's in front of us. And then, you know, the personnel we have, the guys that we've had on this team, the core group that we've had on this team, you know, to kind of keep that perspective and keep our values in line, you know, our priorities in line. What's most important? You know, what's actually important here? And, it's obviously everybody goes through the same season. You know, some teams might be harder than others, you know, but, I mean, what we're playing for, the opportunity in front of us, you know, what we have, you know, the opportunity we have to accomplish something great, it's, you know, not a lot of teams get that. Not a lot of players, you know, get that type of opportunity. So, you know, looking at it from that way, shifting your perspective in that way, understanding, you know, okay, you know, it might be some hard days here, but you got to pay the cost to be the boss. And, I mean, we're willing to do that.
You got to pay the cost to be the boss. Sean Livingston joins us for another moment or so. Sean, you mentioned Steve Kerr, and again, I think if you're on the outside looking in, it'd be easy to say, and I see this, I'm sure you hear it too, how hard could his job be? He's got all-stars and Hall of Famers across the board. They're great guys. They got great chemistry. You can go ahead and address that. Is that a hard job? Does Steve Kerr have a hard job?
Oh, man. You know, everybody says that they could do Steve's job, you know? But it's really, it's not as easy as it looks, you know? It really isn't. I mean, obviously, you know, I tell them all the time, hey, that's why you get paid, you know, because it's like when there's issues and problems and things, he's the one, he's the leader of the ship, you know, he has to right the ship, you know, when we have adversity and hits the fan, of course, he has addressed the media every day, you know, who wants to do that every single day, you know, it's not an easy job, so it's definitely more challenging than it looks, for sure.
Clones, we've got a brand new sponsor for the Daily Jungle. Let me tell you all about On Deck. Do you need help managing cash flow, hiring employees, purchasing inventory, or upgrading your office space? Getting access to capital is incredibly challenging and it's time-consuming for small business owners. I've got your solution. On Deck. On Deck is 100% committed to small business owners with fast, easy, and tailored financing. You can get funding in as quickly as 24 hours with term loans up to $500,000, lines of credit up to $100,000, none of which require business collateral. On Deck is the secure financing service that business owners everywhere can truly rely on. If you're a small business owner and you need access to capital, go to ondeck.com/Rome. That's ondeck.com/Rome right now. As an exclusive listener to this podcast, you will receive a free consultation with one of their U.S.-based loan specialists. You can apply online or by phone and get approved in just minutes. Once again, go to ondeck.com/Rome. That's ondeck.com/Rome for a free consultation. Do that right now. We go to the hotline. He is not at work. He is on the phones, presumably still in the hospital with his newborn, EP Adam Hawk. Bro, is it Jay Buhner or Edgar Martinez?
It's actually, it's John Olderud, actually. I went with Oldie from WSU.
How do you spell Olderud?
O-L-D-E-R-U-D-E, John Olderud.
Hawk, it's Olerud. There is no D on the front end. Olerud. O, like Ole. O-L-E-R-U-D, dummy.
John Olderud, yeah. Yeah, actually the kid's name is Jonathan Ray. He was born yesterday, 9/43, C-section. My wife is a champ. She's a hero. She's a titan. We are in the hospital room right now. I got the baby on my left hand, a phone that I'm illegally dialing out from on my right hand. And, yeah, we're living the dream at Kaiser Permanente.
All right, so you sound great right now. So how is the baby? Tell me about Jonathan Ray.
He's good. He's chilling.
Is he eating?
Yeah, he's eating a little bit. He's trying. He's doing his best. His mom's doing her best. But I'll be honest, you're catching him right after probably the biggest moment of his young 24-hour life. He just went in for the snip, and now he's back. And he wasn't too happy when he got back from that, but you know, he'll be happy the rest of his life, you know.
Yeah, no, I know that's tough. That is such a hard thing for the parents too, right? Is that not gut wrenching? That is gut wrenching.
Oh, it's terrible. And they hand you this pamphlet. I'm looking at the pamphlet right now. It's called Circumcision. It's your decision. And we decided yes. And the baby is not too thrilled about it right now, but he's knocked out on some, you know, pediatrician-approved painkillers, and he's just chilling on my left arm right now, and I'm sure when he wakes up, he's going to let us hear about it, but right now, he's all good.
You know what you should do? If I were you, and I'm glad I'm not, but you should get your ink artist to come in and hit you up, ink you up with Circumcision is Your Decision.
I love, love, love that idea.
You got to do that, man.
No, I'm going to. I will. Now, he's just down the road from where we're at right now, and if they allow visitors past 8 o'clock, I'm going to have him come in and put Circumcision, it's your decision, right on my right forearm.
You should do that. Now, what is your status? I'm not saying get back in here, but I'm just curious, how long, because you made it seem like you're not very happy where you are, how long are you all going to be where you are?
So it was a C-section, which means that they don't discharge you right away.
Right.
They keep you here for at least 2 days, so we'll be here at least until tomorrow, maybe Thursday, depending on how my wife is doing. You know, this is a big time surgery.
How is she?
So,
how is she?
Well, thank you for asking. She's doing great. She's sitting right next to me. She's doing excellent. Appreciate you asking. And yeah, she's been the MVP so far. And I told you, I texted you, this place is like a prison. It's got crappy food. I'm sleeping on a terrible bed. I want to leave, but I'm not allowed to. And the fellow inmates around me are making a lot of noise. And I just want to get the hell out of here with my family. But we're here for at least another 24, maybe 36 hours. And we're looking forward to getting home. Can't wait.
Adam, remind me, who gave birth to that child? You or your wife?
My wife did.
Okay, let's not forget that. And you know, you're on a pretty big radio program. What you just said about that so-called prison is going to work its way back to the people who work at that prison, and it's going to get even worse for you. So why would you say that?
Because I would say it to their face, honestly, at this point, Jim. But you know, I got some.
Yeah, why don't you roll up? Why don't you roll up on that attending nurse and say, you know what, your prison sucks,
okay.
Nurse.
So I got some advice from Alvin Delora, who knows a thing or two about having kids, and he told me during open enrollment, he was like, dude, you got to sign up for Kaiser, because if you know you're having a kid, man, this is like the cheapest way to go. Just get through those 48, 72 hours and get ready for a dramatically downsized bill. So this will all be worth it in the end.
All right. So and you're right, it's a significant surgical procedure. Did you happen to peek or take a look at that significant surgical procedure?
Hell no. So this is my second C-section. Well, my wife's second C-section. The second time I've been in the room. And
You have never had a C-section, Hawk. Yeah. Trust me on that.
I would like surgery, though, on my back, because I threw my back out on Saturday. So right now, I'm in a bad way. But more on that in a second.
Dude, nobody gives a damn about you. Your wife just had a C-section and gave birth to a kid, and yet you're still making it about you. Oh, my back. Oh, I'm in prison. You gotta get a back tramp stamp. Circumcision is the decision.
That's right.
You'll feel so much better.
Yeah. My wife's giving me that look right now.
Because you're embarrassing her again.
Of course. So yeah. What were we talking about?
Anyway, you were talking about your sore back.
Yeah. So I threw that out on Saturday, lifting up my daughter, and I was just thinking about the clones and how badly they wanted that to happen. Because when I ripped off that shoe sales lady, everyone said, "I hope you throw out your back," and it literally happened 13 days later. So I've got a thrown out back right now. I've got a surgically repaired wife. I've got a kid. I got another one that's staying with the in-laws right now. And I got a job to get back to. My question is, why would anyone do this more than twice? You know, you see the people with more than two kids and you're like, who does this more than once? It's all about the sibling play. You get your kid, you get your firstborn a sibling, and then you're done. I have no idea why people would want to go through this more than
twice. Because there are people who are not about themselves like you, Hawk. They're about the family. They love kids. They love family. More is better. They're not all about themselves like you.
That's fair. That's completely fair. And to those people I say, Godspeed, God bless you. I could never do it. I'm two and done. I can tell you that. Absolutely.
Oh no, I would have quit. I would have quit after one if I were you. But
yeah.
Just kidding, Adam. All right, listen, you sound great. I'm glad that mom is good. I'm glad the baby's good. Just do what you gotta do. Try not to alienate anybody else in that prison or hospital, and get your ass home and take care of your fam.
I will do that. Thank you so much for the words of encouragement, and to all the clones that wished my family well on Twitter. I really appreciate that. That was awesome. Thank you for all the love and support. Looking forward to getting back to the show, and I hope you guys have an awesome time at Torrey tomorrow. Obviously, you know that I would love to be there, but I'll hook up with you guys when you get back from Atlanta, probably.
Howard Beck joins us. Good to have you back. Howard, how are you?
I'm great, Romy. How are you?
Super. Great to talk to you. So I mentioned Sean Livingston. Howard, let me start right there. I know he's somebody you think very highly of. I know you had him on your podcast earlier this season. In fact, what do you make of Sean as a player and as a person?
He's, you know, obviously, as you know, one of the stand-up guys of the NBA, a really thoughtful guy, smart player, smart person, consummate teammate, and a guy who you can't not root for. I don't care. I know there's all this Warriors hate and backlash over the last few years, and, you know, people are tired of them. That's fine. I get that. But you can't be a fan of sports and of the NBA without feeling at least some good feelings about Sean Livingston because of what he came back from after, you know, snapping his leg and nearly losing it all those years ago. And for him to go from a guy who was projected as, you know, certainly a franchise star, a guy who people were likening to Magic Johnson when he first came in the league, to becoming just a phenomenal role player everywhere he's been, but in particular for this Warriors team. I mean, he's one of the best stories, feel-good stories of the NBA in the last decade.
I think that's very well said. I think he's one of the best feel-good stories of the NBA for the past decade. I'm going to call him, in all the years I've done this, one of the all-time good guys in any sport, any walk of life. He's something else. Now, they've won 8 straight, and they're on a tear right now. For all the talk about their chemistry earlier this season, how Kevin Durant fits into everything or anything, what do you make of what you see from Golden State right now and how they're playing?
Not entirely surprised. I mean, I think that, you know, unless you were an incredible pessimist or cynic, nobody could have written them off when they were struggling early. Whether that was about the usual just kind of early season doldrums or the chemistry issues, the flare-up between Draymond Green and Kevin Durant, whatever it was attributable to, you know, Curry being out for a bit, I never thought that it was somehow indicative of the Warriors' imminent demise or precipitous decline. I know some people felt that. I know some people felt like this is the moment. Like, we keep waiting for that moment, that maybe this is finally the moment where some combination of fatigue, boredom, tensions, whatever, cabin fever, something, that this was where it was all going to start to erode. And I thought, you know, that was possible. But to me, I still felt like at full strength, when they're healthy and everybody's in a good mood and want to win and want to demonstrate who they still can be, they will, and they have. And that blowout of the Nuggets was so telling, because you and I both know, Jim, this is what athletes do. You know, you say, statement game, it's a big one coming up, is it? They all mean the same, it's all 1 of 82. BS. That was not 1 of 82. That was absolutely not just a shot across the bow. That was like a nuke across the bow, basically saying, you've had a nice season, Denver Nuggets. It's great that you're going to make the playoffs, and you've got some good things going there. Nikola Jokic is having an all-star season, but you're not the top team in the Western Conference. That was very clear. And they can that's the thing with this team. They can do that when they need to. They can summit that on cue. And they did. And I think that, you know, whatever we might see for the next couple months until the playoffs get here, and there will probably be some other periods where the Warriors kind of drag a little, and maybe DeMarcus Cousins will keep that from happening because it's given them some new life and energy in the rotation. But if they drag a little bit, I'm still going to say, you know what, the real Warriors will be there in April, May, and probably June.
Howard Beck is a senior NBA writer for Bleacher Report. He is the host of the Full 48 podcast. You know, really quickly, Howard, you mentioned DeMarcus Cousins. How have they played, in your eyes, in the two games with Cousins, and how do you see him fitting in the rest of the way?
Well, I mean, good early returns, but not surprising that, you know, the first game was like, you know, good numbers in short minutes because he fouled out, and the second game was not as good a numbers in shorter minutes. I mean, he's gonna be all over the map. You know, the Achilles injury is probably the toughest to come back from in the NBA. And to expect that he's going to be the old DeMarcus Cousins at an all-star level immediately, or maybe even any time this season, is probably unreasonable. What they need from him is simply to be a presence, to be a physical presence down low on offense as well as defense. To hit those open threes now and then because it keeps their spacing good. And you know, he's also a really good playmaker, Jim. Like, this is one of the other aspects that gets overlooked. You can put him in the post and the same way that you do with Draymond Green and have him playmake from there, except the difference is if Draymond Green doesn't have an open passing lane, there's not much else he can do down in the post, but DeMarcus Cousins can still do some damage down there, Achilles or no. So I think he's given them a breath of fresh air. They needed some other variable to make this campaign, attempted title run, feel different than the last few.
You know, it's a great point. And they look like they're having fun. I mean, they're smiling again. The energy is good. The spirit's good. Their body language looks good. Sean Livingston was talking about those things. Howard Beck is my guest. Now, Howard, changing up. A while back, you wrote a tremendous piece, I thought, about Carmelo Anthony and LeBron and the fact that they had a conversation going back to a hotel staircase when they were in high school. They both have had amazing careers. But what do you think Melo makes of the fact that he's just been traded to Chicago and the Bulls have no intention of playing him at all?
Yeah, and this comes obviously, you know, months after he was traded to Atlanta purely as a salary dump by Atlanta, where they traded Dennis Schroeder's contract to Oklahoma and they immediately waived Carmelo. So this is now going to be twice in, what, 6 months or something that Carmelo is dealt purely for the purposes of a cap transaction and payroll savings. And that goes for the Rockets, too, obviously. They traded him away instead of cutting him because they wanted to save luxury tax money. It's sad. I mean, it's. I don't think that those are necessarily reflections on Carmelo, the person, or as a character. It's just a reflection on where he is in his career at age, what, 34, maybe going on 35. I mean, he's up there in years. He's, you know, was not particularly effective in Oklahoma last season, and he certainly wasn't effective for the Rockets, which is why they pulled the plug on that experiment. And look, no one's knocking down his door right now. If they were, they could have dealt him on his minimum contract anytime in the last couple of months. And it's been, I think it was November 9th is his last game or something. So, you know, you never know when the end is going to be for the All-Stars, for anybody. But in particular, the Stars, you know, one day they're still performing at a high level and averaging 25, and then one day it's just not there anymore. Is that the case for Carmelo? I mean, we'll see. The Bulls will eventually retrade him or waive him, and we'll, you know, probably after the trade deadline, February 7th, somebody else will then pick him up off the waiver wire, and we'll see what he still has to contribute. But Jim, the only thing I'm skeptical of is this. If Carmelo didn't want to play third wheel in Oklahoma, and he clearly did not, he said it, and he didn't figure out how to do it in Houston, where one of his best buddies, Chris Paul, was running point and playing next to an MVP, I just don't know if there's a better situation out there. He's not going to go anywhere where he's going to, you know, get 17 to 20 shots a game again. Like, those days are gone.
See, that's my thing, Howard. I think for the right fit, he can still score the ball. I just don't see the right fit. Now, is there any way at all? I mean, obviously, it would stand to reason he and LeBron are tight. Now, the Lakers, I think, are one of those teams that you mentioned that's not exactly knocking down the door. I mean, is that thing going to play out? Is it inevitable that he's going to end up here, or maybe not?
Well, I guess it depends on whether or not there's a more attractive option out there. And also, even for the Lakers, I think they've got to make room for him. And
right.
So that means dumping somebody. And is Carmelo better than your 15th man? Maybe. I mean, again, not intending to say that as an insult toward Carmelo. It's just he's not the same guy anymore. It happens to everybody. Also, like, in today's NBA, Carmelo's really a four. And if you look at all the guys they have who can play the forward spots, obviously, you've got LeBron, you've got Kuzma, you've got Ingram. There's not exactly a gaping hole in the rotation in that area. What they really need is an upgrade at center and probably shooting guard. So I don't see where Carmelo really fits there other than he's LeBron's guy. Like, if LeBron weren't with the Lakers, we wouldn't even be talking about Carmelo going there.
Exactly right. Howard Beck joining us for a few more moments. Now, Howard, you and I have talked so many times over the years, but I think there's a pretty good chance I have never asked you about a team that I'm about to ask you about right now. And if I did, it was not in positive terms. I'm talking about the Brooklyn Nets. They've won four straight. They're two games over 500. Given what little GM Sean Marks and head coach Kenny Atkinson had to work with, how impressed are you with what they've done?
Jim, it's one of the most impressive, like, under-the-radar impressive things that's been done. And it's going to be under the radar because they're not going to contend for a title anytime soon. They probably won't get anybody on the All-Star team, though D'Angelo Russell certainly merits consideration. But what they've done, if you remember, when Sean Marks and Kenny Atkinson took over a few years ago, they were labeled the most hopeless team in the NBA. Not just the worst, most hopeless, because they were going to have no talent and no picks of their own to work with, so being lousy wasn't going to gain them anything in the draft. And yet here they are with Spencer Dinwiddie, who they picked up off the scrap heap and has played phenomenally. Joe Harris, they picked up off the scrap heap and has got new life in his NBA career. D'Angelo Russell had fallen out of favor in LA, so again, a rehab project. And then they kept acquiring low picks by taking on other people's bad contracts. So then they got the picks that became Caris LeVert and Jared Allen, and then they, you know, these were low first rounders too, and that's a crapshoot in the NBA. But they aced those picks, and LeVert's barely even played this season. He was their best player when he went down, and you know he's been gone for 2 months. So they still can get better, not just because they have youth that's growing, but LeVert's going to come back at some point in the next couple of weeks, I think, and they'll be that much stronger. I mean, I think they're going to make the playoffs, and to have gone from most hopeless team in the NBA to back in the playoffs in such a short period of time, while the Orlando Magic are still trying to figure it out after being in the lottery year after year, and the Bulls are still trying to figure it out, the Knicks across the river are just an utter disaster. I mean, you look at the teams that have missed the playoffs for much longer periods than the Nets, and they're going to be back, and without ever having picked high in the lottery themselves.
It's a good story. All right, finally, your latest podcast features a conversation with Sharif Abdul-Rahim. He's the president of the G League. What was it like to catch up with him, and how much has the G League changed the way NBA teams handle their rosters?
Yeah, love Sharif. Great choice by the NBA to lead the G League, and at a critical moment here. He's coming in at a really interesting time because they are on their way to a 27th team. In the next 12 to 18 months, they think they're going to be up to 30 teams. And it may change. People might be like, the G League, what do I care? Like, I don't watch that. All right, that's fine. The key thing is this. Once you have 30 G League teams with direct affiliations with the 30 NBA franchises, suddenly eliminate the age limit and have a true minor league development system so that if you pick a teenager, you pick a high school senior high in the draft, but he's not ready, but you had to draft him because you think this is the guy who 3 years from now is going to be the best in this class. Well, now you got something you can do with him. Now you can send him to your G League team that you have under your control, where you hired the coach and they run your stuff and they've got your medical staff and the kind of care that your team prescribes. Now they can grow into the player that you hope they'll become under the NBA team's supervision. So that's the key thing, and that's the league that Sharif is inheriting as the new league president, is a league that's on its way to becoming a true minor league system for the NBA and will pave the way for the age limit to go away and for true development to happen. And it'll make it a lot more exciting, too. I mean, imagine it this way, where the top pick in the NBA draft, if we can eliminate the stigma, maybe that guy gets picked and goes straight to the G League on an NBA salary. And now you've got actual reason to want to watch those games, just as you might if you were like a hardcore seam head in baseball and you like watching the guys rise through the minor league system and you see the stars of tomorrow. That's what the G League could be becoming in the next several years.
Talking all things NBA with a senior NBA writer for Bleacher Report. He is also the host of the Full 48 podcast, Howard Beck, my guest. Howard, great to get caught up. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Jim. Always great talking to you.
Good night now.